Threat Film Radio. One World International Human Rights Documentary Film Festival in Prague, Czech Republic.
Threat Film Radio. I'm Matt Micucci from the 2020. I always almost get the year wrong this year. It's not started on the right foot. But anyways, where we are is certainly the One World Human Rights International Documentary Film Festival in Prague in the Czech Republic. And, well, I'm very pleased to be joined by Jerry Rothwell. Thank you very much for joining us, first of all.
It's good to be here.
And presenting the film, The Reason I Jump. It's a very exciting film to be talking about. I had the pleasure of watching it, so I'm looking forward to our little chat. But just for the benefit of the listeners, I think it would be best to sort of open up with a little overview of the film, perhaps just something about what it talks about and just an introduction, I suppose.
So it's a film based on a book, The Reason I Jump, by Naoki Higashida, who's a 12-year-old, non-speaking, autistic Japanese boy. And he wrote the book by pointing to letters on a piece of cardboard, basically. And the book describes, the form of the book is 58 questions which people ask him about autism, and it gives his kind of answers about his own experience. And it's an incredible piece of writing, I think, for a 12-year-old boy. You know, some of it's very poetic, very thoughtful, and in lots of ways kind of completely counters our image of autism, and particularly of non-speaking autistic children.
So it starts off with a book, basically. It's a starting point, right?
That was a starting point. I mean, when I went to Vitka and talked to Naoki, who's now 23, he wrote the book when he was 12, he was kind of very happy for the film to be made, but he had kind of one rule, which was that he wasn't in it, which from a filmmaking point of view is like kind of being thrown this kind of curveball, because the obvious film to make is one that's about him. So instead, what we did was try to create a very kind of immersive film that took you into the everyday lives of different non-speaking autistic people around the world, and used the book as a sort of key to help us understand those experiences.
Yeah. How did you find out about this book?
So actually the book was really came into the kind of English-speaking world through the novelist David Mitchell, who lives in Ireland.
Atlas, right?
Yeah, who wrote Cloud Atlas and many other great kind of books. He's married to a Japanese woman, Keiko, and they have an autistic son who's also non-speaking. Keiko had discovered the book within the sort of Japanese autism community, and they found it really really useful to help kind of understand their son, I think, and decided to translate it. And the translation has become kind of very successful in terms of in that kind of autism world. I mean, I think it's been translated into 35 languages now, which is phenomenal for a 12-year-old kind of pointing to letters on a bit of cardboard.
It is very it's phenomenal. That's probably the right word to use, I would say. I mean, did you have a personal reason for being interested in the film? How familiar were you with the autistic thing?
I mean, I've done a certain amount of kind of work around learning disability and autism. You know, I made a film 10 years ago called Heavy Load, which is about a learning disabled punk band, and some of the members of that were autistic. You know, my first job was teaching animation in a day center. Not my first job, but, you know, in a very early job. So I used to work for an advocacy organization which was using like video as a sort of advocacy tool around autism and learning disability. So it's a kind of area that I knew something about. But despite that, I think the book did, you know, was something of a revelation to me. And initially, I was quite skeptical about the book. Actually, it's like, okay, how much has David upped the ante on this in his translation? How much has, you know, how much? What's Naoki's actual kind of input into this? But when I met Naoki, you know, I was utterly kind of convinced by it. You know, he's apparently, you know, his behaviors are sort of classically autistic. He will get up, walk around the room, start talking about something else, sit down, repeat words over and over. And then in the midst of all this, type this incredibly eloquent poem or phrase.
Did that meeting actually end up influencing the film then overall?
Yeah, I think one of the questions I asked him in that meeting was kind of where were you at as this 12-year-old writing this book? You know, and I think I remember him typing this sentence out, you know, it maybe took sort of 10 minutes, but what he typed was, you know, when I was a child, I wasn't sure that I was a human being, which is like an incredible phrase, really, for someone. Oh, I felt incredible to sort of think about what it must be like for a child to wonder whether they're human or not. And I think that sort of made me read the book in a different way and made me see actually the book is a kind of this kid trying to understand the ways in which he's different from other people and trying to reclaim that as human and trying to reclaim his own humanity. And I think that's the sort of shape of the film as well.
You know, that question that you mentioned actually makes me think that it's such a universal book. There is a universal dimension to it, aside from the fact that it is totally, about specifically autistic experiences. But speaking of which, I mean, did you always know how you would approach this sort of filming translation of the book, even though it does have elements that aren't strictly related to the book?
Yeah, I mean, no, not at all. Of all the films I've made, I think it's my 8th feature talk. It's the one where I've most been just kind of led by the nose and not really known what I was doing. You know, like at least partly the subject matter meant you couldn't really plan it in any detailed way. So you very much had to respond to what people were bringing to it and the people you were shooting with. And then I think it's sort of trying to, I mean, obviously you can't know for sure what's going on in another person's head, you know, whether they're autistic or not. So you're making kind of assumptions about that. And I think that universality that you're talking about is quite important. There's a writer called Donna Williams who wrote a great book called Autism and Sensing. She's an autistic writer, and she kind of says, you know, all of us understand these experiences that autistic people have. You know, sometimes we're all overwhelmed by sensory input, or there's something really distracting that we're focusing on that means we can't understand what's going on in front of our eyes, or we find certain things overwhelming, kind of emotionally. Or physically, but you know, there's a massive difference between experiencing that, you know, when you're stressed or drunk or on drugs or whatever it is, and living there all the time. And I think that is, you know, hopefully none of these experiences are kind of alien to us there, but the film hopefully helps you understand that what that might be to live with that constantly.
Right. And it does that via documentation of people and their own life experiences and all of that. And then there's another side in which you sort of attempt to translate these quotes from the book and just what the book talks about visually, which I thought was very interesting, a really interesting process, because sometimes it's as simple as just a shot of a particular thing, like a wheel spinning or so on, yeah, lots of different things. I'm just wondering, how do you do that? I mean, do you make a list of these things on a notepad, or is it just more impossible?
I mean, there's this thing Naoki says in the book. He says, you know, how does the way I see the world? He's trying to understand whether he sees the world differently from other people. And he says, you know, he comes down on the idea that he sees the detail first, you know, and then it takes him a while from all of those fragmentary details of something that's in front of him to put together the whole picture of understand what's going on. And I suppose we took that idea into the way we visualize things, often focusing lots of shooting with macro lenses and small detailed sounds and things which were kind of had patterns and which span or which, you know, had certain kind of rhythms to them. And usually we got that from the situation we were shooting in. So, for example, Amrit lives in a room in a high-rise block in India. You know, in that room, in her flat, her family's flat, you know, there's lots of fans. There's a table fan and there's a fan on the ceiling. And we just kind of started to sort of shoot and use the rhythms of those fans, which have this kind of slightly hypnotic, distracting kind of effect, and try and put the audience in the position of thinking that that's the most important thing, you know, like the fan, when you're in that room, it's the fan that you notice, nothing else.
So you were observing the places where you were filming and trying to keep that sort of a perspective in mind as you're filming and also just looking at the place where you're shooting. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, for me, it taught me a lot about filmmaking, actually. I mean, the editor, David Sharrop, I think he said that what he kind of got from it was actually that this kind of way of seeing was actually the heart of what cinema is as well. You know, cinema frames, you know, puts a frame around something, looks at the detail, kind of emotionally links it. And actually, there's a lot of the language that we're starting to use that just felt just very cinematic.
Yeah. I was thinking as well, in terms of structure, it is possible to kind of see this film as differently structured from your average documentary, and perhaps perhaps this too takes into consideration, I presume the book, I haven't read it, but also autistic perspective.
Yeah, I mean, the book has in some ways has quite a flat structure. It's a sort of set of questions and answers, which, but I think there is a shape in it, which, as I say, is this sort of kind of coming to understand yourself shape, you know, and that was the shape that we took into the film. And I suppose if the film has a structure, it begins with an understanding of the sort of sensory experience, sensory world, and then it takes you into that sensory world becoming overwhelming and the way in which that might change your behavior. And then it kind of takes you out into language and sort of advocacy and people that are beginning to be able to communicate, Ben and Emma in the States. And then it takes you further out into sort of society and stigma. So it's this kind of starting on the kind of very small detail and then trying to go out to what does this mean for our societies.
All right, sensory experience. Just before the interview, you mentioned the sound being particularly different, particularly important in this film too, right?
Yeah, so we fairly early on, so I decided I wanted to work with a sound artist called Nick Ryan. One of the reasons for that is that Nick is synesthetic, so he I don't know how to describe it, neurologically there's a combining for him of sounds and images. So, you know, Thursday is yellow, or the sound of a lemon is, you know, cack, or, you know. And actually synesthesia is very common in people, in autistic people. So I don't know, you know, maybe that's helpful. But Nick said, you know, let's try and do this in 360-degree sound. So we started recording every location. We recorded in 360. That involved kind of running three recorders at the same time. We had this incredible sound recorder, Sarah Lima, who managed to handle all of this on her own. Kind of, we recorded kind of 360 Atmoses in every place we shot. And then mix the film in 360. So hopefully, you know, when it's in the cinema, as many cinemas as possible are able to show it in Dolby Atmos, which is the 360 format we used, we'll be able to experience the film in 360. And we've also made I think it's possibly the first, certainly maybe the first documentary ever made in, feature documentary made in binaural, with a binaural mix. So binaural is when you reproduce the 360 experience through the headphones.
And that's cool. That's really cool. There would be so much that I'd like to ask you, but we have actually gone over time already. But I want to ask you one more question. I feel like a very important theme in this movie is just a theme of communication, the desire to communicate with other people, and especially when you're talking about people for whom communication is just a difficult thing. Right, that is another driving theme I felt.
Yeah, stereotype of the kind of autistic child is they want to be off on their own in a corner, you know, and I think the book speaks to the opposite of that. I think Naoki says, you know, without communication, I'm not alive. You know, for him, it's critical. And I think in the film sort of moves us towards the characters in the States, Ben and Emma, who have found a way of communicating. And that, to me, kind of suddenly really opens out the film, because you're suddenly aware of the sort of consciousness behind these behaviors that you've been seeing for the last kind of half hour.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It was a great pleasure talking with you.
Cool. Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I remind our listeners that the film is called The Reason I Jump. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.